Republican leaders in Congress say they support an investigation of a second set of strikes on a boat in the Caribbean. Lawmakers who had been obedient until recently now have questions. So what changed? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. How can both parties declare victory in Tennessee's special congressional election? I'm Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Republican won, but by a much smaller margin than President Trump carried that same district last year. Also, a $6 billion donation would give many children money for investment accounts. How do they work and what kind of difference would they make? And we'll ride along with the scientists scouring the country for rare minerals. It's Wednesday, December 3rd. This day in 1947, a streetcar named Desire opened on Broadway. Stella! The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, held talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday in Moscow. There's been no breakthrough on a peace agreement that would stop Russia's war in Ukraine. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports from Kyiv that Ukrainians are not surprised.
Ukrainians say Russian President Vladimir Putin does not want peace. He continues to bomb their cities nearly nightly and believes he's winning in the east, even though Russia lost 25,000 soldiers during the month of October alone.
Putin cannot stop.
That's Ukrainian military analyst Mykhailo Samus. He says Putin has been trying to destroy Ukraine since 2014.
These operations in Crimea and still he didn't destroy Ukraine, so he's angry and he will continue.
Samus says Ukrainians cannot give in to Putin and will never agree to give up territory. He says the most Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky can sign for is a ceasefire because there will be no real peace as long as Putin exists. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
Republican and Democratic lawmakers want more information about the deadly U.S. military boat strikes in the Eastern Pacific and Caribbean. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says the House and Senate Armed Services Committees will investigate.
I have every confidence that the policies that this administration is employing when it comes to keeping people in this country safe and ensuring that our policy is one of peace through strength, that those policies are being adhered to and followed.
But the Republican leader did not explicitly offer support to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Hegseth is being scrutinized over the decision-making around a second strike on a boat in the Caribbean last September. Two survivors of that initial boat strike were then killed. Republicans have held on to a Tennessee congressional seat that was up for grabs in a special election held yesterday, but they won by a much slimmer margin than in the past. From member station WPLN, Mariana Bacallao reports on the victory by Republican Matt Van Epps.
At the Maxwell House Hotel in Nashville, Republicans celebrated after a heated race for Tennessee's 7th congressional district. Last year, the GOP swept this district by 22 points. Van Epps fended off a challenge from Democratic State Representative Afton Bain, winning the election by about 9 percentage points. That's according to a race called by the Associated Press. In his victory speech, Van Epps said Democrats shouldn't own the conversation on affordability.
And together, we'll bring down the cost of living. I'm tired of too many Republicans ceding affordability to the Democrats.
Van Epps will be back on the ballot next year for the midterms after he finishes out his predecessor's term. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacallao in Nashville.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Afghan man accused of shooting two National Guard troops last week in Washington, D.C. has been formally charged in the attack. Rahmanullah Lakhanwal faces a first-degree murder charge in the killing of Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom. He faces other charges in the wounding of Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf. Lakhanwal was wounded in an exchange of gunfire during the attack. He pleaded not guilty from the hospital bed. The death toll from a gigantic fire at an apartment complex in Hong Kong now stands at 156 people. Hong Kong police are still searching through the wreckage. But reporter Cherise Pham tells us some residents have been allowed to return.
It's been 1 week since the fire tore through 7 high-rise towers at a public housing complex in Tai Po, a northeast suburb in Hong Kong. Residents from the one tower that was spared from the fire are returning to their apartments. They can't move back in, officials say, but they can collect personal belongings. Meanwhile, Police are still searching through two of the buildings, warning more bodies could be found. Hong Kong's leader says a committee will determine the cause of the fire and make recommendations to prevent future tragedies. For NPR News, I'm Cherise Pham in Hong Kong.
Many regions in South and Southeast Asia remain in disaster mode. They're recovering from deadly flooding and landslides following tropical storms. At least 1,400 people have been killed in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Malaysia, and Vietnam, and nearly 800 of these victims perished in Indonesia. Hundreds of thousands of survivors lack clean water. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
The COVID pandemic, 2020 through 2021, those were tough years, especially for chefs like Josh Wobbolt. Restaurants were closed, and he was suddenly out of a job and found himself delivering food for DoorDash. It paid the bills, and Wobbolt had other irons in the fire. He'd been putting out applications and auditioning for whatever reality TV cooking show came his way. If he got one of those, that could be a big step up in his career. One which had begun years ago when he was a latchkey kid growing up in Elk River, Minnesota. He was the guy who was always toting a cookbook and trying out his new recipes on his siblings. He had his own take on cuisine, which was inspired by his parents' homelands, Cambodia and Thailand. One cooking show did look like it was going to pan out until someone got COVID and it was canceled. But finally, in 2023, Josh Wobbolt got his TV debut in Hulu's Secret Chef. He didn't win the $100,000, but his spicy shrimp soup stole the show.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Trump administration continues to face questions about a U.S. attack on an alleged drug boat in September in the Caribbean.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told reporters at the White House on Tuesday he did not witness the second round of strikes that killed survivors on the boat.
I watched that first strike live. As you can imagine, at the Department of War, we got a lot of things to do. So I didn't stick around for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, where all the sensitive site exploitation digitally occurs. So I moved on to my next meeting.
Hegseth has a long history of advocating more lethality, as he calls it, with fewer lawyers. In a moment, we'll hear what a former high-ranking military lawyer thinks. We begin with the facts.
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh is with us. So we just heard Hegseth say that he had a lot on his schedule the day of that strike. What other details did he talk about Tuesday?
He said he gave the initial order to strike the boat and then said he learned the details about the second strike a couple of hours later and said it was a decision made by Admiral Frank Bradley, who leads U.S. Special Operations Command. While Hegseth stressed he personally didn't make the call for a follow-on strike, he said Bradley had the complete authority to do so.
And by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat.
You know, it's worth noting that Hegseth's comments yesterday are different from his initial response when the Washington Post first reported on these strikes and he criticized their reporting. Now he's acknowledging there was the second strike. President Trump, for his part, said he knew the military took out the boat, but he didn't know whether it was one strike or two or three, and he wasn't involved in it.
All right, so what are top Republicans on Capitol Hill saying about the attack?
Both House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune say they backed the move by House and Senate Armed Services Committees to review the boat strikes and expect to get answers. The Speaker said he wouldn't prejudge anything before they get the facts. Committees are expected to seek video and audio of the operation. Questions on the Hill really center around whether the second strike broke U.S. law or would be considered a war crime if the administration's claim to be at war with narco traffickers is accepted. And members of both parties want to review evidence and this timeline. Majority Leader Thune said he backed current U.S. policy, saying he agreed the administration had the authority for these attacks in the Caribbean. But when Thune was asked directly about whether he has confidence in Hegseth, he sidestepped the question.
Well, I think that the fundamental question is the country safer than it was under the Biden administration? I think the answer to that is unequivocally yes.
Thune said the Trump administration's peace through strength policies are working, and Hegseth is part of the team that put those in place. But he also added that Hegseth, quote, serves at the pleasure of the president, not exactly an endorsement of the secretary.
All right, so it seems like both GOP leaders of the House and Senate want at least some answers. Any word on how they'll try to get them?
You know, we haven't seen a lot of oversight from Republican committee chairmen in the first year of the Trump administration. But I will say on this issue, both chairs in the House and Senate came out really quickly and vowed vigorous oversight of these boat strikes. It's unclear if they're going to have public hearings or classified sessions. Admiral Bradley's in town and is expected to brief lawmakers later this week. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer wants Hegseth to release the video of the attack, and he's demanding that he testify publicly.
All right, that's NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has a long record of questioning the military's rules of engagement. He used to talk about it as a weekend host on Fox News. In 2019, President Trump reportedly considered pardoning American service members under investigation for or convicted of war crimes. And Hegseth said this.
You train someone to go fight and kill the enemy. Then they go kill the enemy the way someone doesn't like. And then we put them in jail or we throw the book at them.
Hegseth wrote his own book, which included a chapter titled More Lethality, Less Lawyers. In that book, he tells a story of being a junior officer in Iraq and telling his platoon to ignore the advice of a military lawyer about when they can open fire on a perceived threat. After he became defense secretary this year, Hegseth summoned military leaders to a meeting at Quantico, Virginia.
We fight to win. We unleash overwhelming and punishing violence on the enemy. We also don't fight with stupid rules of engagement. We untie the hands of our warfighters to intimidate, demoralize, hunt, and kill the enemies of our country.
Let's discuss this further with retired Major General Stephen Lepper. He ended his military career as the Deputy Judge Advocate General of the Air Force, JAGS, as they're called, are military lawyers, and there is a profane term for JAGS, which Hegseth uses in his book. General Lepper is now with a group called National Security Leaders for America. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
You're chuckling because you know that term. We can't say it here on the radio. We've heard what Hegseth has said about military law, but as defense secretary, what has he done about it?
Well, I think, one of the reasons why this story has become such a topic of discussion among Americans is because it's awakened the American conscience. Americans cannot understand how the most respected military in the world got to this point, a point where our military, which has always been considered by Americans in the world as the good guys, became capable of crossing over a bright line into illegality and immorality by targeting a disabled vessel in which two survivors were clinging to life. And I think, as your setup indicated, that as Congress investigates this and as the facts come out, I think we'll find that the road that has taken us to this place didn't start with an illegal order from Hegseth or from Admiral Bradley.
Where did it start?
It started when Hegseth fired the Army and Air Force Judge Advocates General and communicated to the military that the law and lawyers are roadblocks to orders that are given by a commander-in-chief. And then he continued when he told the world that the Department of War would be focused on his, quote, maximum lethality, not tepid legality.
Is he right that the lawyers can sometimes be too restrictive?
No. In my 35 years of active military service, my role was to advise commanders on where the guardrails existed so that we did not veer off into an area of illegality and immorality that would ultimately embarrass our country. The law of war actually focuses the application of military power on the things that will provide military advantage. They don't undermine our ability to prosecute military operations.
Well, I'm thinking about the story he tells in his book, and that's a story of his troops in perceived danger and restricted from, as they would see it, eliminating a threat. I guess we should ask, is that at all a factor in the Caribbean? Was anybody in danger in that situation in the Caribbean so far as we know, any American?
No. And as a matter of fact, one of the facts that lead many lawyers to conclude that this is not a legal operation in the first place is the fact that these are not armed vessels. They're, you know, presumably carrying drugs to our shores, and there's an attempt here to create an equivalency between drugs and arms. And so, you know, any notion that these vessels pose a risk to our forces because of the armed force that they carry is just ludicrous.
I just want to ask about the differing accounts of what the bottom line is, really, given the differing accounts. There are different details and different reports about exactly who ordered which strike, but it seems confirmed now there were multiple strikes. Some people survived the first strike, and the U.S. military struck again. Granting that we may not know every single fact, are you prepared to make some kind of judgment as to whether those second strikes were legal?
Well, we do need to wait until all the facts come out. We need to understand and remember that a bedrock principle of U.S. law is that everyone is presumed innocent until proven guilty. But given the facts that I'm aware of, and even if you consider them in the best light possible for the forces on the ground who had to make that decision to conduct that second strike, this was a vessel that Secretary Hegseth, as recently as yesterday, said was on fire. And as such, was disabled at the very least, destroyed at the very worst. And the bottom line here is that even if it was only disabled, it was no longer navigable, which meant that the only way that the survivors on that vessel would survive is that if they were rescued. Once we have rendered a vessel capable of survival only if it's rescued, our obligation then shifts as well from attack to rescue. And so under those circumstances, even in the best light possible, I don't think that anyone can say that this was a lawful order.
Retired Major General Stephen Lepper, thanks so much, sir.
Thank you.
The Foreign Service is in crisis. That's the view of the American Foreign Service Association, which used to be the State Department's union. It lost its bargaining rights under the Trump administration and has not been able to push back against the cuts it says have left morale in ruins. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
The American Foreign Service Association, or AFSA, surveyed more than 2,100 diplomats. 98% of them reported low morale, and 86% said the Trump administration's changes have affected their ability to advance U.S. diplomatic priorities around the globe. AFSA President John Dinkelman calls it a dire situation.
The diplomatic corps of the United States feels the effects of what has been undertaken in the form of managing their workplace to the ground.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's been streamlining what he calls a bloated bureaucracy. Thousands of Foreign Service officers and civil servants lost their jobs when he dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development. He then laid off another 1,300 State Department employees in July. Some of those people were told their final day would be this Friday, though Congress made clear that there shouldn't be layoffs while the government is operating under a continuing resolution. Dinkelman estimates that about a quarter of America's diplomatic service has been let go or taken buyouts.
That's a tremendous slash in firepower, in brain power.
And he says the assignments process at the State Department is in shambles.
The mentality with which one bids on a position has not historically been, where can I go to assure that I'm not going to get canned in the next 3 to 5 years?
But now, he says, diplomats are focused more on job security than on where their language and diplomatic skills could be useful for America. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
This is NPR News.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support. From this station. And from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters December 12th. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. And from Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Tech billionaire Michael Dell and his wife Susan Dell are donating more than $6 billion for investment accounts for American kids. They made that pledge on Tuesday, and they say the money will go into what are called Trump accounts. How much difference will that make? NPR's Stephen Bisaha reports.
Michael and Susan Dell told NPR they have big dreams for what their donation can do, like helping young people buy a home,
starting a business, or saving for their future.
The money will go into Trump accounts, created as part of the Republicans' tax and spending law passed this summer. Kids born between the start of 2025 and through the end of 2028 will get $1,000 put into an investment account that will ideally grow into their adulthood. The Dell's money will go to kids 10 and under who did not qualify under that law to get a $1,000 start.
That's an extremely impressive amount of money to contribute.
Alex Morshanu is with the Tax Foundation. But as huge as $6.25 billion is, it does not go that far when spread out to a planned 25 million kids.
In the context of the U.S. population and, you know, the spending capacity of the federal government, it's not as large as it might seem at first glance.
Each kid will get about $250 from the Dells. The money will likely grow with the stock market, but it's going to take a lot more investment to make a dent in something as life-changing as a down payment on a house. Ray Bochera with the Aspen Institute has been advocating for these types of policies, and he's hopeful the Dells' donation could inspire other donors to step up.
I think that's exciting. And, families, employers, nonprofits, cities, states, they can all make these contributions. And enough people do that, we're looking at pretty substantial sums by age 18.
And that is what Michael Dell is betting on, inspiring more investment.
What's more important than investing in children?
The Dell's donation will go to children living in zip codes with median family incomes below $150,000. Bochera says this represents a different kind of investment than we typically see for children, not just nutrition and health, but an investment in their future wealth. Stephen Bisaha, NPR News.
All right, for more on what parents should be thinking about when it comes to these Trump accounts, we've called up Stacey Vanek Smith. She's a reporter for Bloomberg's Business Week and host of the podcast Everybody's Business. So, Stacey, we've been hearing this plan be described as individual retirement accounts, IRAs for kids. I don't know what kid is looking forward to retirement. How should their parents be looking at these accounts?
Well, it really does function a little bit like a retirement account where you can make tax-free contributions. The child's family, even an employer, can make contributions into these accounts. And then once the child turns 18, they can start withdrawing these accounts for things like we just heard, a down payment on a house or education, things like that.
All right. So are these accounts automatically set up? Do people have to set them up? How are they going to work?
It sounds like a lot of the details are a little murky. What the White House has said is that parents or guardians are responsible for setting them up and managing them, which, as you can imagine, could put a lot of pressure on parents or guardians who maybe aren't as familiar with financial institutions as some other people might be.
Yeah. What about taxes? How is that going to work?
Well, a lot of the contributions would be tax-free. I believe okay. for parents or family members, it would be $5,000 a year tax-free. Employers could contribute $2,500. So these accounts could add up, but I think that's also contributing to worries that the accounts could look really different for different children when they turned 18. Obviously, the amount of money in them could vary enormously.
Is this going to be one of those things where parents are going to have trouble managing them as the years go on, or might it be something that easy? Maybe they just think about once a year or something like that.
I think that is a really key question because we don't know a lot of things, but certainly, you know, this is going to be managed through private financial institutions, which means there could potentially be administrative fees or things that, you know, you and I probably have dealt with our own financial institutions and banks. It's something that you kind of have to watch for. It could really put people who maybe are less familiar with these kinds of financial instruments at a pretty big disadvantage, and we don't know how it would be regulated yet.
Are there any rules for what you can actually invest in?
Well, the money would go into, from what we know, what is called an index fund or some kind of index fund, which is just an investment fund that's pegged to the S&P 500 or the big stock indexes. So I don't think it would go into like individual company stocks, but more of a kind of market gauge. But it would give people a stake in the market and the incredible wealth that has been created there recently.
What about the possibility of these accounts maybe affecting the wealth gap between rich and poor families?
That's an interesting question. And I think that is sort of the intention of these plans. President Trump has said that these accounts would give people, quote, a shot at the American dream for middle class kids. I'm not sure how true that is, just because depending on how much you are able to contribute into the funds, those accounts will look really different. I mean, by the White House's own calculations, if you made maximum contributions into the plan, by the time you turned 18, you'd have about $300,000. If you were not able to make any contributions into the plan, you'd have less than $6,000 when you turned 18. So I'm not sure that really addresses the wealth gap.
So, Stacey, I mean, Republicans broadly have had negative reactions to universal basic income programs, you know, guaranteed income programs. Yeah. A lot of them call them socialist cash handouts. So, okay, maybe these Trump accounts aren't necessarily the same thing, but are they somewhat in the same ballpark?
I mean, I think cost-wise to the government, these would be pretty substantial. The president has said for babies born between 2025 and 2029, the U.S. Treasury Department would put a $1,000 kind of starter deposit in these funds. That would total around $13 billion. Now, as far as what that would look like, I mean, I think the money would eventually go to people. I don't think it's going to solve some of the immediate problems now people are feeling, especially after SNAP benefits have been cut and other government benefits. It will cost a lot of money. I'm not sure the payoff will be as immediate as maybe voters would want it to be.
Stacey Vanek-Smith is a reporter for Bloomberg's Business Week and the host of the podcast Everybody's Business. Stacey, thanks.
Thank you, A.
This is NPR News.
Midterms are less than a year away, and election officials across the country are already preparing for the possibility of interference by the Trump administration.
At this point, I think we're all just kind of used to, all right, what's the next crazy hairball thing that's going to pop up?
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What election officials are watching for as midterms draw closer on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. In just a bit, you're going to get your daily dose of phonology with John Latimer, where he takes a look back at his nature notes from this date. Thank you to everyone who donated to KAXE during Give to the Max. You made a difference with your contributions. We can't thank you enough. You can still help us finish our year strong. Give at KAXE.org. There's a sensory-friendly Santa event December 4th through the 6th at Northland Arboretum in Baxter. Register for a 15-minute time slot and learn more at northlandarb.org. Click on Events. Artist Nelia Harper French invites you to the attic in Old Central School in Grand Rapids to make an ornament. Hours are noon to 4, now through December 6th, plus during the First Friday Art Walk. All materials will be provided. The Clearwater County Historical Society hosts the Festival of Trees. Enjoy more than 30 trees and vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. Special events are happening each weekend through December 21st. Grand Rapids Tax Aid is seeking volunteers for the upcoming tax season. They are looking for people to prepare taxes and those who would rather help in other ways. Email taxaidgr@gmail.com. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. You can cut your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forests. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. Now for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, December 3rd, 1984, sundogs appear on the flanking the sun on the east and west sides, or the 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock portions of the clock face as you look at the sun. Sundogs are a refraction of light coming from the sun through ice crystals that are high in the atmosphere. And they only occur when the sun is at a low angle. So if you're going to see sundogs in the summertime, you're going to have to look early in the morning or late in the evening. But in the wintertime, when the sun's angle is lower in the sky, sundogs can appear just about any time of day. They need ice crystals high in the atmosphere. These ice crystals are usually sort of pencil-shaped. They're long, thin, six-sided hexagons that refract the sunlight in a way that creates this flash of light on either side of the sun. And it is typical of winter and clear, cold days when we see the sundogs.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From Storyworth, each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, Storyworth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at storyworth.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Okay, Republican Matt Van Epps has won a special election for a U.S. House seat in Tennessee. That means the Republican edge in the House of Representatives doesn't get any narrower. But Democrats are also claiming victory after Tuesday night's results.
That's because last year, President Trump won Tennessee's 7th congressional district by about 22 percentage points. Yesterday, Van Epps won by 9. Both parties spent millions of dollars in the final weeks of this race to try and test their campaign message ahead of the 2026 midterms.
NPR's Stephen Fowler has been following the campaign. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
Why did this race receive so much attention?
Well, it's math. Republicans have a narrow House majority and fractious coalitions. This gives them one more vote until Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene resigns in a few weeks. Here's more math. In 60 state legislative and congressional special elections this year, Democrats have improved from their 2024 margins by an average of 13%. Those elections were typically low turnout, low profile contests where Democrats were more likely to vote. So given Trump's margins in this Tennessee district, super PACs from both parties poured more than $6.5 million in recent weeks into making this a high turnout, high profile contest where Democrats still ended up improving their margins by 13%.
Oh, really interesting result then. And it seems that Democrats turned out a lot of voters. Who's right in declaring victory then?
Well, the final margin of the race means both parties can, with a straight face, declare a victory moving forward. That's because Republicans motivated their base without Trump being on the ballot. Van Epps said in victory remarks that, quote, running from Trump is how you lose, running with Trump is how you win. But he actually didn't campaign much using the president's name or accomplishments. And Democrats are putting 2024's losses behind them and have also motivated their base, who's been pretty sour on the party as a whole. And they seem to also have persuaded independents that Republican governance won't solve key issues.
So in last month's elections, we heard a lot about affordability. I'm thinking about that as a political slogan, six syllables, lots of syllables. But anyway, the economy is what that was about. How did it factor in?
Well, Steve, one candidate decried career politicians and promised to bring down prices, create good-paying jobs, and lower health care costs for working families. The other candidate promised to shake up Washington by making health care more affordable, bringing down the cost of living, and protect workers and small businesses. If you're wondering which one was a Republican and which was a Democrat, you're not alone. It was pretty hard to tell them apart on this issue, which was also notable for the candidate's lack of talking about Trump.
Oh, this is really interesting. The Democrat maybe didn't talk about Trump so much because she wanted the votes of former Trump voters, and the Republican didn't talk about Trump so much because he's not so popular at this moment. But with all of this said, I mean, we're reading all of this to look at 2026 and trying to find how we can forecast the future. Is there anything about Tuesday's result that truly matters when thinking about the midterms where things will be different?
Well, clearly the economy is top of mind. Republicans are figuring out how to address those concerns about costs without explicitly crossing Trump, and Democrats are also workshopping ways to win back key parts of their coalition. Looking at the election results, the drop-off in turnout in deep blue areas that we saw last year is nowhere to be found, and the rightward leap of young voters and non-white voters has snapped back towards Democrats. In a midterm year, the dynamics typically see the party out of power do well, so this is another data point in favor of that trend continuing.
NPR Stephen Fowler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, now we have a story about the hunt for rare earth elements. China dominates the global supply, and the U.S. is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to find more critical minerals here, including some rare earths. Now, they're important because they're needed to make tech products and also for the military. Shauna Lewis with member station KRCC takes us along on the search on the ground and in the air.
At a small airport in the mountains of southern Colorado, geophysicist Angela Farr places a laptop inside a gleaming blue helicopter.
Basically, my job is to make sure that the equipment's set up and collecting good data, and then...
Farr works for a contractor collecting data for the U.S. Geological Survey's Earth MRI project, which maps the planet's surface and subterranean landscape. Farr points to a large box behind the pilot seat.
It has five crystals in it, four pointing down and one pointing upward, and that measures the radiation off the top couple of inches of the Earth, and then what's coming from the sky.
A long white boom called a stinger sticks out from the front of the helicopter. At its far end is a red bulb holding gadgetry to measure variations in the landscape's magnetic fields.
Sure, everybody wants to know what's inside that red thing.
Yeah, sure they do. They really do, and they're always disappointed.
She opens it up.
Then one thing you'll notice is there's no metal. It's polyethylene screws and it's wood because we don't want to introduce a local field.
Soon the helicopter takes off. The pilot flies a grid of lines that's sort of like mowing the lawn at a constant height above the ground. Patricia McQueen with the Geological Survey describes what the grid overlays.
Ancient volcano guts that got heated and munched over billions of years.
Those guts are already pretty well known. Prospectors swarmed over this territory starting in the 1800s. Some of it has been mined previously, and the USGS has mapped it multiple times over the decades. It's doing it again now because Congress has allocated more than $300 million to improve the maps. That started when President Trump called for more domestic mining in his first term. President Biden continued the work, and most of the money for it came from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act he signed in 2021.
All right, so where are we going?
Well, we're going to look at one of the outcrops near Salida.
Data gathered by sensors on helicopters is also ground-truthed by geologists like Ben Magnan, formerly with the USGS.
So the first thing the geologists will do will go up to the outcrop and they'll bang on the rock and try to pull off a sample.
Magnan follows up his low-tech rock hammer with a pocket-sized box called a magnetic susceptibility meter.
And so we just beep it once on the rock, once out in the air, and then it spits out a value. So this is low. This would not produce a magnetic anomaly in the airborne survey that we're flying.
So if an anomaly was detected by a helicopter here, it would be coming from underground, not the surface. This kind of work, overflights and ground truthing, and even a satellite partnership with NASA, is happening across the country, from Alaska to Wisconsin and Florida. President Trump's 2026 budget request proposes spending another $137 million on exploration for minerals and energy resources in the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Shauna Lewis in Southern Colorado.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, your spaghetti night could be getting a lot more expensive. The Commerce Department has plans to put in place heavy tariffs on imports from over a dozen Italian pasta brands. So Italian pasta could vanish from store shelves or even double in price next month. Listen more on the noodle negotiations in the NPR app or on this reliable public radio station. This is NPR News.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Or go online to KAXE.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Klein Jamboree next Monday.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. The KAXE Book Club is reading The Road to Tender Hearts by Annie Hartnett for December. Meetings are at 5:30 Wednesday, December 10th at KAXE in Grand Rapids, or Tuesday, December 16th at KBXE in Bemidji. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive, now through December 12th. Drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River include Essentia Health and Northern Star Cenex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. And the Iron Range Area Council of Minnesota Chippewa Tribes has their annual Christmas party tomorrow at 6 p.m. at Marble City Hall. Enjoy a potluck dinner and native bingo. Itasca Waters continues their free practical water wisdom series Thursday, December 4th at noon, called Water Wishes for the Holidays. Presenters will present a joyful hour of water-themed children's books that spark curiosity. Register at itascawaters.org. And the Brainerd Noon Sertoma Club presents Winter Wonderland, a drive-through light display at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd. It runs Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 5:30 to 8, plus the full week between Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Advance tickets available at BrainerdNoonSaratoma.org. Now back to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Self-driving taxis are hitting the road more often in cities such as Phoenix, Los Angeles, and Austin. They hadn't been seen much, though, in the snowy upper Midwest until now. Now, one local transit system is trying out autonomous vehicles in northern Minnesota. Here's Chelsea Perkins of member station KAXE.
A fleet of autonomous vehicles is the star of the day at a launch celebration in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Snowflakes fall as a parade of vehicles drives slowly by, headlights flashing, and a local driving instructor breaks out in song.
The future of transit is now at hand with self-driving vehicles across the land.
This is Go Marty 2.0. MARTI stands for Minnesota's Advanced Rural Transit Innovations, a free on-demand transportation program. And for those without their own vehicles or with mobility issues, it can be life-changing. 76-year-old Myrna Peterson is a wheelchair user and one of the regular riders.
I put many miles on my chair, about 1,600 a year. And whether it's raining or snowing, I'm usually out there in my wheelchair.
Peterson is one of the dynamic forces behind the launch of the Go Marty program, along with local and state partners and federal grants.
This literally gets me off the street because it's a warm ride, plus an opportunity to visit with these amazing operators.
Go Marty 2.0 is an expansion of the program, which began 3 years ago. There's now more hours of operation, 70 more stops, and three new handicapped accessible electric Volkswagen vans named Buzz, Polly, and Pickle. And it also serves the neighboring Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Reservation. The crowd cheers as Peterson, the guest of honor, presses a button that shoots confetti in the air. And she's a little teary-eyed.
I'm all about quality of life. Opportunities for all ages and all abilities. I just think it's great that this will get people to the grocery store, to their medical appointment.
All of the autonomous vehicles have a navigation system developed by May Mobility, a Michigan-based company. Spokesman Karsten Cutterer says the vehicles take stock of their surroundings.
Here's a pedestrian right up here walking a dog. So it notices all of that, and then every second, it's analyzing thousands of potential scenarios of what could happen. Is this person possibly going to cross the street, or is this car going to turn in front of me?
Well, the AVs operate autonomously about 90% of the time. Minnesota law requires a licensed human driver to help operate the vehicles. Megan Horak is one of them. On this day, she's taking people on ride-alongs in a vehicle named Miru.
Honestly, since it's a small town, you see the same people. A lot of the same riders are repeat riders, nearly everyone. And so you get to know them.
Michael Reyes is a planner with the Leech Lake Band Tribal Development Office and helped to bring the service to the reservation. He says transportation barriers are especially acute for tribal populations.
We all complain about it. We all know it's a problem, but nobody did anything. Omar came forward.
Now, those autonomous vehicles are becoming better at handling snowbanks and icy roads, learning that's necessary for providing a critical transportation service for rural residents in northern climates. For NPR News, I'm Chelsea Perkins in Grand Rapids, Minnesota.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I just wanna make the love.
Heidi Holt, and I want to thank you for helping us this year, especially. It's been a rough year for public media, but you have come through for us over and over again. You've come through when we've had matches on the table, when we have needed your support more than ever. Thank you so much. If you didn't get a chance to do it, you can still give for the end of the year, tax-deductible donations. Go to KAXE.org. That's the one that I've been talking to when I say, take to myself. Oh, love, I just wanna thank you.
Would you risk your life going to the moon? Would you risk your business?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Ninja One, helping organizations simplify endpoint management to automate IT and strengthen security all from one platform. More at ninjaone.com. And by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, multiple published reports say President Trump today will announce weaker fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks. This would reverse a Biden-era requirement that fleets get to 50 miles per gallon within about 5 years, Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
This federal rule takes into account each automaker's entire fleet of vehicles. If the average fuel efficiency across all their cars and trucks don't reach the standard, they get fined. But over the summer, the Republican-controlled Congress made a crucial change. They zeroed out the fines. So carmakers that fall short don't have to pay anything. The Trump administration appears ready to lower the fuel efficiency standard anyway. That's become something of a tradition in the last few decades. When Republicans are in the White House, they lower fuel efficiency requirements. When Democrats are in, they raise them. Trump has eliminated other federal policies this year that had pushed carmakers to build more electric vehicles, including consumer tax credits and a rule that allowed California to set its own higher fuel efficiency standard. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Bitcoin down 13% in a month, but jumping 6.4% at the moment this morning, 93,000 thereabouts. Stocks, NASDAQ futures are flat, S&P and Dow futures are up about a tenth of a percent. And another number, the number of shoppers over Thanksgiving, including the Friday and the Monday, 202 million, up 3% from a year earlier, and that's above the National Retail Federation's estimates. The group says it was sale prices at work, with people prioritizing gift-giving over, say, travel or restaurants. Half of all spending was clothing, but get this, 26% of the spending was on gift cards. Is that really shopping or is that money transfer?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by Total Wine and More, offering wines, beers, and spirits for fall celebrations. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
There is an isotope called helium-3 that could cool new quantum computers. It's rare on Earth, plentiful on the moon, at a market price of $20 million a kilo. It might make economic sense to harvest the stuff from up there. This week on the Marketplace Morning Report, multiple views on an emerging moon economy, how it might work, and whether it's even a good idea. Today, one of the companies that's working on both recycling space refuse into useful stuff and making units that could help power the lunar economy. It's called CisLunar, and its co-founder and CEO Gary Kalman joins us. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great.
You know, you hear about building railroads on the moon, maybe to pick up stuff that gets mined on the moon. Your company is doing some thinking about, well, once you mined it, what useful things might it be turned into?
That's right. So when we look at the economy, thinking about, you know, how can we be on the edge of human expansion into space, there was a gap for, you know, taking those resources and turning them into something manufacturers could use. Somebody needs to be the steel mills in the, you know, in the lunar economy and in the space economy in general.
You're also in the recycling business. Tell me about that.
We realized early on that, you know, there's a lot of spacecraft out there, a lot of space debris. So why don't we go after this space debris as a first feedstock to learn how to do this? And then later on, as we were studying the lunar economy with DARPA and some other companies, we learned that, hey, if we use recycled landers and other metals that we bring that are already, you know, refined, we can actually really enhance the efficiency of the process of even taking virgin materials and turning them into something we can use for manufacturing.
Yeah, because in orbit, there's a lot of junk floating around.
Yep.
Some of it looks just like a spent satellite. Some of it are little annoying bits that can be dangerous. You see that as a possible resource?
Eventually, yeah. We've done a study early on about how do we turn space debris into metal propellant, fuel for an electric propulsion system. And so you combine that with our power capability and our furnace capability to manufacture the fuel, and you could turn, you know, space debris into delta V, as they call it in the industry, which is what how you get around in space.
I mean, it's got to be a challenge for a company, right? Because some of the stuff won't actually work for a while. And then when's it going to make a profit for somebody? You have to stay alive in the medium term. Now, that could be grants. But along the way, you've developed technology that might have a more immediate practical effect that people might want to buy now?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the grants are essential. The SBIR program, critical for our company to get to where we are. But one of those programs, we learned that the power system we had built for processing metal was something we could use for the entire space industry when you, you know, actually transmit information or you do sensing or you run an electric thruster or really anything else on a satellite. You need electricity. And every time we make power, we have to process it, transform it, so that it can do whatever job it's going to do. We make the box that does that processing from the source. You know, we get that energy coming in, and we turn it into the energy coming out that you need to do whatever the job is you want to do.
There isn't a lunar economy yet. Isn't that fair to say? I mean, like, it's not like there's an active economy on the moon yet.
Not yet, but it is right around the corner. I mean, there's a lot of investment going into it. There's a real urgency around government, you know, making sure that we have a position on the moon for geopolitical reasons. And what's coming next is taking it from every mission brings all the things with it to an idea where we have a diverse lunar economy where you get there and then you tap into the services that are available, just like you do on Earth. You know, you buy your utilities and you have your trash service and you buy your resources or whatever the things are that different specialist companies provide. And that'll be where it gets when we get to a real lunar economy.
Gary Kalman is CEO and co-founder of a company based in Colorado called CisLunar. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I also spoke to a moon economist, and we'll hear later this week from an expert on ethics and technology about the wisdom of all this. Our interviews are accumulating at marketplace.org, and don't miss my pitch about what my hobby, designing and launching big rockets, has taught me about the stock market. That video is on Facebook and Instagram. Marketplace APM is our nickname there. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Area book lovers are invited to a book swap at the KBXE studio in Bemidji. Bring a book, take a book on Wednesday, December 10th from 5:30 to 7:30. Also talk about your favorite books with fellow readers, staff, and What We're Reading host Tammy Bobrowski. Used books from the Red Door Bookstore will be available for purchase. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st, 2026. Funds will be earmarked for the